live from the Pathway Studios in Johnston proper. You are live from the Path.
And you are listening to Live from the Path. We're coming to you from the Pathway Studios, still in Johnston proper. It's good to see you on this evening. Mike, I feel like it got a lot darker.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
It's creepy like a basement.
It looks darker.
Sorry, we're, if you can see this at home, so you can catch a little bit of it, but we're getting settled in our new joint. And so we painted the walls all black. I don't know if this was wisdom or not, It can get a little dungeony,
kind of like
here.
A cave.
Yeah, it has the potential for cave-like activity.
I've seen a lot of people pull off all black walls, and maybe we're just not suited for it. I don't know. It looks so. Here's the thing: it doesn't translate over video as well. You know, like as you see it as you walk up the stairs, it looks pretty uptown. But after that, I don't know.
What? Maybe we shouldn't be wearing all black clothes.
Well,
crap. You know, I thought about that, and that is a risk on my part because I always have a black shirt on, almost always.
You know, I tend not to wear things that really pop. Zing, you know what I'm saying? That's just kind of not me. But, I mean, I could consider it if it will help, you know, negate the mistake of maybe painting all the walls dirt black.
I was going to say, I could start wearing hot pink if I absolutely need to, guys. I'm willing to take that hit if
I like
it makes
to call it
better.
Salmon.
Yeah, it's hot pink, Dan.
Yeah, but I like to call it salmon.
All right. So here we go. Here's what we got going on the show tonight. We'll have some advice on Dear Life and the Path. There's no better way to get us rolling in the new place without giving him some worldly advice for people that make mistakes like, you know, set up a studio that's completely black. Wow, man, what was I thinking this week? There was a couple things that were on my mind this morning, and now I've completely forgotten what they were.
You know, I was listening to a gal on the radio today. They were talking about the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge.
Yeah.
And she had called in and was discussing that you know, one of her family members had died of ALS when she was younger, like in the 70s or whatever. And she was just outraged at the stance that the Catholic Church had taken because of the embryonic stem cell research.
Yeah.
And so, and like, it was, we might talk through that just a little bit because it was odd the way that she was talking about the fact that the Catholic Church was not listening to the people. And, like, I thought, man, I feel like it's not up to debate.
Good job, Catholic Church.
On how the people feel about it, right? I mean, I feel like we talk about time and time again that your emotions just flat out cannot be trusted in certain areas. But like, it's an interesting conversation. And actually, the gal from the local ALS chapter out here had a fairly decent rebuttal to what she said. So we might talk about that a little bit.
Okay. All right. That sounds good. Also, let me start with this. Because it kind of had a little bit to do with some of that ALS stuff. And let me try to think. Here's a warning. Not everything is mega offensive to Christ. Just because there isn't a just because his name isn't on it doesn't mean his work isn't being done. And I think there's this segment of Christianity that says anytime you see a broad culture moving towards something or rallying around something, and especially when you see churches start to participate in it, I think you get these beacon people who want to make sure that you're not sinning in it, right? And I don't mean, hey, they're looking out for your best interest. I think they're naysayers. They're just people that want to take a crap on something that otherwise, you know, people can agree on. And say, well, you better be careful because you might be making that an idol. Ice bucket, idol.
Yeah, it's this group that jumps up a lot and says, see, I'm smarter than you. And they like to kind of continually prove that. That's the feel I get often when you hear that. I'm going to write a blog. I'll show you guys how you're all wrong and I'm smart.
Yeah, and there's like a superiority thing to it, too. It's like, hey, I know you thought you were doing a good thing, but you might be sinning. Yeah. I have some folks on my Facebook feed that are like this, and they're pretty consistent with it. And I don't know, I just got really kind of pissed out of the day because I thought there were two or three things that were going around that people were getting involved with, and I could almost count on this small handful of people to post something from some obscure blogger somewhere that condemns this in one way or the other, where you didn't know that you were offending the Holy Spirit by participating in it.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, actually, this ties to something else I was talking about. Hold off, Mike.
And here's another thing.
I got more stuff. Just another Facebook item that I got kind of cheesed at this week. I see the stupidest Jesus questions on this Facebook. And I don't mean like people saying, like people who don't know Jesus trying to get to know him. I mean, people talking about dumb stuff that I could care less about.
Actually, I feel like I saw that exact same conversation on Facebook because we share a lot of the mutual friends. And it was an exercise in every way to discuss Christ but do nothing. I mean, it was an absolute hamster wheel of theological debate.
Oh, man.
I mean, it was just ridiculous. There was the word exegesis came out. There was people writing in actual Greek. I mean, it was obscene on how far that this thing had gotten. And I'm like, you know, you're not making any gains here. Like, you could have taken the 30 minutes that you've spent coming up with this rebuttal and fed a guy, you know?
Yeah,
like,
that's exactly what I thought. I thought, hey, you know what? Go feed a man. Hey, you know what? There's a naked guy out there somewhere. Go clothe him. Boy. And here's what I guess what I was thinking. And I see this actually pretty consistently in certain theological circles. But, like, do you revere your theology so much that you actually don't live in a kingdom? You're like a biographer of the kingdom of God, a guy that writes about it. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? But, like, you hold your theology higher than the action that the theology is to point to, right? I spend more time studying Jesus than trying to be like Jesus. And I don't know, there's a risk. There's a serious risk in that. I think I saw that. This isn't to say, like, whoever involved in the conversation isn't doing that, but, like, I wasted my time having even looked at it.
No. And here's the deal. Here's where it kind of ties in. It was funny because I saw the first time I saw Les Mis, I saw it this week, right? And I saw it in the movie form. It was okay. I was somewhat disappointed at how Master of the House went down. I thought it was better in the original, English action. But, like, I walked away from watching that movie. You guys all seen Les Mis? Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
okay.
I have not.
Yeah. Okay. So, like, I mean, if you haven't seen it, the crux of the story is it's a musical. And this guy had done like 19 years in prison for stealing bread for his, I think it was his sister's, you know, young son in like 1800 English or France or something. And anyway, he goes to jail for like 19 years of hard labor, comes out, and finally, you know, bumps around. No one will hire him because he's got bad papers that says he's a felon. And he ends up staying at a church stables at a church one night. And the pastor, the priest man, invites him in, says, look, you can stay here. You can enjoy the comforts. And he ends up trying to steal all the silver. And then he runs out of the place and tries to hawk it. And the guards who are running the place bring him right back and say, we caught this guy with your silver. He's trying to steal it. What do you want to do? And the priest is like, no, I gave it to him. And I can't believe you leave without the most expensive item. And he tried to give him like these silver candlesticks or whatever. And so basically it was a picture of grace, right? Like the guy was dead nuts guilty. He had totally stolen the stuff. And the pastor man's like, look, no, I gave it to him. Do a good thing. And the guy's like having this inner struggle. And so anyway, the long story short is like he realizes what God's grace looks like and the opportunity that he's been given. And he spends the rest of his life, and we're talking years, being faithful to that and helping people and like being faithful to just the simple thing of, is I've been given grace, others get grace, I'm going to do good here, and I'm going to care for other people. And like I walked away from after watching that movie and thinking, crap, like I've never wanted something so much in my life, like to spend the rest of my days being like dead faithful to helping other people. Like that just sounds like an awesome life to me. Like, and you get to the end of the movie, the guy dies, he's done a bunch of great stuff or whatever, and he's just sitting there looking around, and he's like, you know, God, bring me into your grace, bring me into your glory. I'm ready to come home now. And like, can you imagine the sigh of relief that a guy who has lived his entire life walking with God and loving other people, that just feels in that transition, right? Like, I've done what I was sent here to do, and like that's and you know, now this kind of ties into what we were talking about, but like nowhere in Les Mis was there a theological debate. You know, it was God showed me grace, I'm showing grace to others, I'm going to help people the rest of my days. You know, and sometimes it was ugly and sometimes it was kind of rough, but like I don't know, like I walked away from watching that movie a little bit more energized than I have in taking in a lot of Christian media. I just felt like, man, if that's what we're designed to do, I could totally throw down on that.
Yeah. No, the counterpoint to that is another character who's in that is the essentially the sheriff who's pursuing him. He was mm-hmm. the, what was he, DA or something? attorney of some kind.
Jean Valjean.
Jean Valjean, yeah.
Yeah, that's him.
He's chasing the guy around knowing this dude is guilty. And, like, everywhere he's looking, he's trying to get this guy to trip up. And he's just looking for ways to get after him because he's just trying to follow the rules as he knows them. And he's just applying these rules, and that's what he's doing. And I think this is kind of tying back into that conversation that you guys are looking at, where you've got these rules lawyers who are debating religious topics instead of actually living the life that Jesus has actually presented. So they'll debate the meanings and the words and all these subtle nuances that have nothing to do with going out and actually feeding people and living the life that Jesus called them to.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, what that broadly points to is I think someone would retaliate and they would say, you know, it's important. These distinctions that we're making are important. And I'm not disagreeing that distinctions are important, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not shattering over there are some certainly interesting things, discussions to be had coming out of Scripture. But when Christ came, so he could have just done whatever he wanted to do and called that the salvation move, right? But he did something. There was a physical act in doing so, and he did it in a specific way. And I think we miss that. Like, we call an event, and we recognize that of all the ways that God could have completed this transaction, right, could have represented to the world how his redemption would come, how this transformation of the world back from where it fell to where he created it to be would come, Jesus could not have died any other way. But there is a reason he died the way that he did, right? There is a reason he lived the way he did. There's a reason he died the way he did. And there's a reason that is an action. He spoke creation to existence. He could have just as easily shown up and said, I'm God. Here's the deal. Redemption's yours if you hear my voice. Yeah, I mean, it's not out of God's purvey to have done that, right? But he walked the earth. He taught us how to live. He lived it, and he took action. And so I think sometimes we miss the perspective that treats the Christ event as just a piece of history that we are to study and understand, versus it is also an ethic. It's something that teaches us how to live, and he did it in that way for a reason. And I think sometimes we miss that. We say, well, he couldn't have died any other way. Based upon how we set it up, that's true. But you got to take into account that he actually could have done whatever he wanted to. He chose to do it this way. And it pointed to something more than just, hey, that happened. Let's kind of fight about it.
Well, that's exactly the scope of the book of Hebrews, right? The book of Hebrews is talking about why Jesus is now qualified to be the most high priest, right? And if you look at his life, like, I mean, what's the brass tacks of what we generally point to the cross is like, he lived a sinless life and died and took on our iniquities, which put us as blameless, right? Nowhere did it say in that transaction that he had to befriend people, make appearances in crowds, tell anyone about his father, go through a gruesome death. He could have just showed up and been killed and died, and that's it, right? Like, but yeah. There was a lot of life interaction that qualifies him to be the high priest that says, I understand what you're going through. I get it, right? Like, I've been there. I understand that. And so that's what makes him, right, obviously the most high priest, because he's gone through all those things and walked out blameless on the other side. And so, like, that's exactly what you're talking about. That's the entire book of Hebrews is basically describing why he lived the way that he lived, opposed to just showing up and dying, and which would have been pretty much the exchange, right? Show up on the earth, take all the punishment for sin, and be done with it.
Right.
Without
right.
all those life experiences in it, without having a friend named Lazarus, without going through any type of pain at all, and could have just done it.
Well, I think the right thing to hear from this is what we're talking about is I take an extremely high view of Scripture, none higher. But based upon the view of Scripture that I have, it requires you to react to it. It requires you to do something. It's not just calling you to understand. And I'm not dismissing the desire to understand. What I'm asking is like, are we fighting for something that grows the kingdom, right? That storms the gates of hell? Because what the gates of hell are holding back people. My question is are our conversations producing fruit that draws people into the kingdom, or are we arguing over, you know, I don't know, wheat, white or wheat on the other side of a pearl gate.
Right. And is the gates of hell laughing, going,
yeah,
that'll keep busy for a while.
Yeah, and shoot. See, this is where you got to be careful. It's because even that white or wheat distinction is not a fair one, right? Because it's not like people are not talking over things that are otherwise, like, I get it. I do get the conversation.
No, because they're saying that they, you know, there's a high view of Scripture here. We want to make sure that we're getting it right. There's nothing wrong with that.
No, agreed. But I'm just, you know, for the amount of time, for what we're focusing on, you know, are we understanding something? If we understand it well enough, we should also see it as an ethic that causes us to do something. And then on the scale of what is important, Christ could have talked about all these things that we debate about, right? Now, to understand me as fully God and fully man, to understand the nature of where I went for 3 days, to understand, like, all this, he could have done that. That's not what he focused on, right? That's not what he focused on. He very much laid out, this is what my kingdom looks like. This is how you live in my kingdom. This is how I fight. This is how we die. This is what it looks like when it culminates. And I just wonder if we are in our discussions always pointing to what Christ is also pointing to, or are we kind of Paul when he talks about you get caught up and it's not the endless genealogies, but it's of a nature to say, here's the things that, okay. I mean, who else is really fighting about that?
No.
I don't know.
No.
All right. I don't know. I get it. I do.
But
you got to do something. No. Do something with yourself. Okay.
I mean, that's the deal, right? Wouldn't you rather live, maybe this is me personally, right? But I would rather live the Les Mis lifestyle. You know what I'm saying? Even if I just know one thing, right? If I just know that God showed me grace, and that was enough to run the rest of my life, and the way that I treated everybody after that, I feel like that's all I really need to know, right? Yeah. And maybe I'm wrong. I mean, I agree. There's some finer parts of Scripture and whatnot, but like, let's say you never had access to the Bible, and all you know is that there was a God in heaven who gave you grace, and your job was to show grace and love to everyone else throughout the world and say, hey, there's a God that gives grace.
Yeah,
that's pretty much it, right?
Is there do sometimes we make a false distinction as if there is anything but a working man's Jesus? I feel like that's what he is. Am I seeing that wrong?
Eric's trying to figure out what you mean by working man.
What would be
man's
an alternative
Jesus
to that?
Well, I don't know.
Like Jesus, the purely academic? Or?
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm saying is.
I mean, we're to study to show ourselves approved. I mean, we're to meditate on Scripture. We're to know it. I mean,
yeah, that's
but that's different than what you're talking about with everybody arguing over the finer points. I mean, that is fruitless.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's still a working man's Jesus.
Yeah, well, Jesus addressed it himself when he talked to the Pharisees. He said, you know what, you guys, I mean, you tithe over the littlest things in the law. And you get all that in order, but all the big picture is you're just missing.
Right. Mercy, justice, faithfulness, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we're missing the big parts of obedience about loving one another and entering into these small-minded debates about just, you know, things that really don't matter that much. And Jesus didn't want to focus on them either.
Yeah, so Paul told Timothy to be watch out for those guys.
Yeah, heads up, man. Yeah. They're coming.
Yeah. There's a lot of things that are just going to draw us off topic, so watch out for it. Even things within the Bible can potentially draw us off topic.
You know, it's funny what this brings to mind, but I was talking to my 7-year-old daughter today, and she was asked to go upstairs and clean her room. And I inspected this room when I got home just to see how it had gone, and the middle of the room was clean, and the rest of the room was terrible.
I mean, it looked like no one had been there.
And I said, what happened? You know? And she said, well, I didn't think you'd care about the corners. I said, when your mom said, clean your room, you know, I mean, I feel like that meant the whole room, you know, from all the colored walls up to the doorways. That's kind of your territory. She goes, yeah.
You didn't say that. You just said, clean my room. And so I didn't think you'd have a big deal about the corners.
Now, here's the deal. Like, I'm acting kind of nonchalant about this. She was weeping at this point because I was not understanding where she was coming from. And she was very frustrated already because she said she did the best that she could, and it was a girls do this, and I wouldn't understand because I am not a girl. And I thought, oh man, touche, 7-year-old.
having two daughters, she might have something there.
Yeah, and so you know, I said, look, there, you know, there's some things I understand, but like, I don't know the way it came kind of into that arena is like she's a bit on that side of it. You know what I'm saying? Like very much on a. I need every piece of information. You really didn't say. I need the finer points here. Clean my room means the middle section or enough to get a walkway through, and then everything else is pretty solid. You know, and it's none of my business to figure out past that. And I thought, you know, like in some regard, I kind of like her thinking. Yeah. You know, because I mean, she walked in, she's like, "Yeah, I did it, and we're pretty good." Now, obviously, I can't let that fly as her father. I got to do something. But I mean, she was content with it. She was happy with it. All she knew is that a part of her room needed to be cleaned. She did that faithfully and then went back to her business with puzzles. And I thought, you know, I mean, on some level, I enjoy her heart there. On other level, she has to clean her room because I said so.
No, oh, yeah. Solid. All right. Mike, so wait, what was you? What was that lady talking about, the ALS challenge?
Oh, yeah, so anyway, they're having a discussion about the ALS challenge. They had a representative from the local chapter of the ALS, and then they had a national person on there and whatnot. And basically, you know, they were telling a story. Some people had called in and talked about their personal relationships that they've had that have passed away from the disease. And it's a pretty tough deal. It debilitates very, very fast. And, you know, one day you can be able to button your pants, and the next day you can't. And it's a pretty rough deal to go through, both for the person and the family. And there's certainly no doubt about that. So this lady was kind of, she called in. She'd been reliving some of this because it happened to her during the 70s with her grandpa. And she was just so upset that the Catholic Church had taken a stance on not on the ice bucket challenge. The Catholic Church has basically come out and said, look, you know, we're not for this because the money's going to go to embryonic stem cell research, which is where they're doing their research to fund finding a cure for ALS. And she was just crying and very upset. And she's like, I don't understand why they've taken this tack. I don't know why they've made this decision. And I'll probably have to back out more from the church than I have because they're just, you know, can't they see that we want something different? And this is not something that we don't support their decision. And I don't know, my heart kind of went out to this lady because, like, I get her source of pain and I get what she's saying. But, like, she had such an inaccurate view of Scripture and the Lord, you know, like the Lord is to be bargained with and, yeah. And his ways are not to be acceptable. Now, you know, the lady from the local ALS chapter, to be fair, rebutted and said, listen, they're doing embryonic stem cell research with one laboratory, and that is strictly funded by one person. Most of the organization is done through adult stem cells, and so, you know, you can kind of direct where your money goes if you're not interested in being part of that, blah, 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 you know, I get that. But like, on the other hand, like, you know, we probably would have a legitimate issue with aborted embryonic stem cells.
Yeah.
You know, that's a problem. And it's a problem because, you know, because the Bible relays it as being an issue. You basically killed something, you know? And so the fact that you think that like the Catholic Church is one to be bargained with because its source is the folks that's a real issue, right? Like that's how you turn a church into a political party really, really fast when yeah. you follow the will of the people. We don't do that. We follow the will of the God that created it. And I thought, man, I just feel so bad because her heart was, it was honest, you know, and it was true. Like the pain that she was feeling was absolutely true, but you have to have a fairly skewed, vision of God to think that the church has made a big mistake by following him.
Right. Right.
And so I don't know. I mean, do you find that as, commonplace? Like people feel like the church or maybe, denominations should be able to move as the people change, as the society moves about and says, here's what we're looking for. We're looking for more of this. You know, can we do that?
Well, it's very commonplace. I mean, it's very commonplace for society to say the church is outdated on this because they haven't moved when society has. And there's actually a lot of churches that will say, you know, like we've been behind on the times and it's about time that we catch up with where other people are at. And we're going to change doing this and we're going to start doing this. And we're going to be a little bit more lenient on who we permit to do whatever. I think that's very, very pervasive. In fact, that's the biggest. I would call that the biggest challenge to the church as a body is basically allowing the outside culture to tell you how to act, right? Because like, what provides definition of a Christian? But the things that we accept, right? The things that we have accepted. We've accepted Christ. And what he has done, we have identified ourselves with a certain way of living. Like our community is defined by the rules that govern it, by the guidelines that govern it. And as those shift outside of whatever God has laid out, our community is less distinct. And frankly, you can make the case that not the same community at all.
Yeah. Right.
That is pervasive, and that's what makes it difficult. That's why you can drive down a main street of a big church, or excuse me, of a big city. And you can see 15 churches, and it's a crapshoot as to whether you walk in one and those guys are teaching the Bible, right? Mm-hmm. Or and even if they're using the Bible, I mean, are they using it faithfully? I mean, you might have a 2 in 10 of getting that because the community branding is the same. We're still a church. We might even be God's church. We're a this. We're a that. right? And we have all the show. We wear what the community wears. We are people dress in the robes, and we have the right books, and the door's got an arch on it because that's what Jesus people have, right? But they've changed how the community lives. It's been altered from what it was, and like that's how you could tell. That's how you tell a Christian or not a Christian is basically what community you're submitting to, and when those barriers start coming down, I mean, you start to lose definition of who you are, and if Jesus doesn't give your identity, then I don't know what Christian means.
You know, that's I don't know. It goes back to that discussion about the two fighting over bits of scripture. I mean, to some extent, it is. I mean, you know, like we said, it's fairly important to stay tight to what Christ described as what the church is supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know, actually, I was talking to my wife about this earlier this week. You know, the picture that the Bible likes to draw between, us and Christ is a marriage picture. You know, it's a fairly good marriage picture. And I thought, you know, we do a lot of teaching on that. We do a lot of teaching out of that, like to love your spouse like Christ loved the church and whatnot. And I thought, man, in that equation, there's a perfect being and a non-perfect entity, right? Like in your earthly marriage, they're both non-perfect. Like, yeah. I still think it's a good point of teaching because it's kind of what we're shooting for. But like in that equation, there's one that's always right. You know, there's one that's correct and just and true and brings a loving kindness that's perfect. And like as I can see, it is as transferable to the marriage picture. It's just, I don't know. I feel like maybe we jam on that teaching a little bit too much, forgetting the fact that the two people involved in an earthly marriage are. They're imperfect folks, you know? And so, like, it's not as easy as a metaphor as maybe I thought it used to be.
I don't know. That seems like a weird tangent, Mike.
What do you mean?
I don't get your relevance to whatever we were talking about.
He's saying that in a typical earthly marriage, you've got compromise between husband and wife. But for the picture that the Bible portrays, you've got Christ and you've got the church, and you don't have this mutual compromise going back and forth. We're supposed to be, as the church, completely submitted to him because he's Christ. I mean, he's completely flawless. So how do you enter into a type of relationship that we're used to here on earth using that as a metaphor? Because we're used to dealing with authorities that are going to give a little bit of pushback or some kind of compromise in terms of, you know, what's going on.
That can't be trusted for.
Maybe this doesn't seem to ring true in my life, right? So like in the church Jesus scenario, Jesus is the perfect one. The church is the fallible.
Right.
In the man-woman scenario, I am the perfect one, and my wife is the fallible.
Yeah.
I feel like that's an exact comparison.
I was kind of, I wasn't sure.
Like, that's what I said. Yeah. You're not catching this either.
I didn't get it at all. I was like, well.
This seems the same.
All right, so me and Herrick's marriage is healthy.
I was going to say, this is kind of how I've taken relationships so far, is I'm the one that does not need to change at all. And she needs to change everything. I feel like that's no.
You know what? I should
do
just
not
bring
listen to these men.
I should just bring a bucket of sand in here, and we can all put our heads in it, and maybe we can establish just about as much as we've gotten already.
Okay, so I'm not perfect.
All right,
fair enough. No, I actually I've had many conversations with people, just talking about the Bible itself and talking about my faith, and I've gotten the standby of, well, how are you following a book that's 4,000 years old, or how many ever 1,000 years old it is? And how is that still relevant today? And I get so many people to try and say, well, that didn't go along with society. Society was this way back then. That's why it was written that way. And I can challenge that. Well, what's changed? You know, just because society's changed doesn't mean that the rules should have changed. Just because society has changed something doesn't mean that God wanted it to be changed that way. And most of the time, people don't have a rebuttal for that because they go back to the, well, it's still a thousands of years old book.
It's old.
Yeah, it's old. Why are you following it?
Hey, you know what? Those same people are the same guy. Well, you know, Confucius says.
Yeah.
As they're guiding. That guy died in 500 BC.
That guy's old also. Exactly. It's how can that still be relevant today? How can that still speak into your life after society's changed so much since then? And I don't understand where they're coming from with that, because we still have a lot of the same things.
Yeah, I'd say society
marriage
hasn't
is still around
that much.
Yeah, marriage is still around issues. The same way that it was back then.
The Bible was saying don't do these things because people were doing them.
Right. Exactly.
It wasn't like, hey, in case you ever think about this.
Right. Exactly.
You know,
homosexuality was happening.
In the future, you guys might want to do this. No, they were doing it then, and he said, don't do that.
Yeah. Homosexuality was happening back then. It's not a new thing we're trying out.
That's true. We have God and people. I feel like that's the same.
It hasn't changed much in general. People were stealing back then. Guess what? People are still stealing today.
Actually,
don't do it.
That's a solid point, right? Like, it's the people, what they're upset about is how the Bible's reacting to it, right? But like the very fact that what the Bible addresses, it's not like it's saying, hey, you know, don't poke someone's eye out with your tablet stamper, right? Yeah. Don't kill people. And the guy's like, well, we're still talking about killing people, right? We're still talking about stealing from people. We're still talking about cheating on your wife. And we just have a different reaction to it. And, like, how has society evolved with how we deal with things when our base problems haven't changed at all?
Just because the Bible doesn't mention Facebook doesn't mean that it needs to be not in a way that it can speak into relationships.
Just like Les Mis. I'm telling you.
Wow. Way to rope that one back around, Mike.
People.
Just like Les Mis. Yeah, I think that...
So simple, Booba. You know what I'm saying? It's just so simple. You get grace, you give grace. That's it. What a life. I'm excited to start it right now. Do all something right. Offensive to me.
Hey, man. That shirt a good idea?
Okay.
Nope.
Okay, is that your 21st century way of offending me?
Well, I didn't want to be super rude on the radio. I figured we'd try just kind of the bare bones of, hey, man.
You should have said something like, your family only owns one donkey.
Nice mixed threads.
Hey, man, you get that boil checked out recently? Nope.
Boy, that's rough, Booba.
Yeah.
You don't know what that boil is.
You obviously haven't seen Les Mis.
Yes, I don't have the grace that he had.
Not with the way that you had.
Probably not.
You're listening to Life in the Path. Hey, thanks for hanging out with us so far tonight.
You're welcome.
We really appreciate it. Big shout out to our two sponsors. We got Bob Eisenhower with the Eisenhower Team. Go to EisenhowerTeam.com for all your home buying and selling needs here in the Des Moines metro area, including Ames and both to the north and south. And EisenhowerTeam.com. Bob, I've been looking at some stuff with Bob recently, and he's as awesome as ever. So EisenhowerTeam.com, get a hold of him if you're looking at a house. If you haven't found one and you need him to hunt one down for you, he's the legs, man. He can go take care of that stuff for you. Also, Westfield Veterinary Hospital, WestfieldVetHospital.com. That's in Johnston, Iowa. And, take care of your pet. You know, sometimes you pet it and you feel a lump and you're like, things are going to be fine. And then you take another pet of it like a month later, and you're like,
it's like a cheese grater.
Yeah, something's not right. You got to take that dog in, man. When have you ever found a lump on your dog, and then it went away 3 weeks later? That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Take the dog in. Get the teeth brushed. Get them up to date on their shots. You know, they you have to get, like, stuff in the Polk County area, right, or they'll fine you?
Yeah, I don't know if you want to go with the scare tactic, Ben.
Oh. Well, I kind of threatened
that's solid advertising.
I threatened the lumps. Shoot, whatever. You love your pet. Take them to Westfield Vet Hospital.
Good people take their pets.
WestfieldVetHospital.com. If nothing else, call Bob, call Westfield Vet Hospital, send him an email, knock on the door and say, hey, thanks for sponsoring Life in the Path. We appreciate you helping to keep us on the air. And if you would go visit them, that keeps them in business. And that's all good either way. All right, Mike, hey, what's on the, I don't know, who needs help in the world?
Here we go. There's all kinds of solid fodder today. Here we go. Dear Life from the Path, my husband has a low-paying job, and I'm trying to see that he gets a better one. But each step I take, he regards as pestering him.
Is this my wife?
Love, Dan's wife.
Oh.
Although he is perfect in every way, I feel like he's wrong here. But each step I take, he regards as pestering him. This has driven us apart from each other. It really hurts me because we are now like strangers living together. Sorry, Dan. What do I do? Sad wife.
Wow, I'd start by just asking how you can support. You know, hey, honey, how can I help you in this? Or should I be involved? You know what? I mean, it's his job. He needs to be taking the lead in it and getting an idea of what's going on. And it's something that is going to be very vulnerable to him because it's his job. So just ask him, hey, how can I support you in this?
Yeah, guys tend to have our egos connected with whatever it is we do. Mm-hmm. She's kind of...
Thanks for the insight, Dan.
Any expert advice you need, I'm here. Expert information.
Dudes are like, we have two elbows. So, yeah, that's kind of a tough subject to breach, unless he's a reasonable man. And then you could say, hey, look, you know, you have the skills and the talent to make a little bit more money. Is there something that you don't want? You think it's going to be too many hours? You think it's going to keep you away from the house? Because, I mean, those are reasonable things to negotiate with. If it's just because you're lazy and a bum, then you might want to consider getting that other job like I asked him. I don't know.
She might want to consider her communication style.
I just said it just like I said it. Yeah. I feel like dudes respond to logical, straightforward behavior. And here's the deal. Everybody gives the woman the advice to kind of sultry up there and be ultra sweet and be like, yeah, you're the greatest husband ever. how would you consider getting a new job, baby? I feel like dudes.
I sure like to eat.
I mean, when's the last time you heard dudes talk to each other like that? You know what I'm saying? They show up, they state a point of fact. Hey, listen, your shoes are terrible. You're going to need to buy new shoes directly. That's illogical. Here's the problem. Here's the solution. Get to it. I feel like I can accept that.
I don't know. I'm trying to think that I might, but I don't know. I think I'd take some offense to that. I'm not saying I should. I'm just saying that I think, like, if my wife point blank said, "Hey, man, I think you're not doing the work that you should be doing,"
then you're defensive. Like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's the deal: you're gonna react poorly right off the bat. True, but it'll sink in a little bit later, and you'll realize that she was right. You'll think, "What have I done that my wife thinks this?"
What would be the harm in saying, you know, hey, like I see more potential. And I want to support you in reaching that. How can I support? I kind of liked it.
I really like my current job.
I think a more delicate touch might be a little more appropriate here as you're getting in.
All right, Eric.
You're talking about something that's pretty close to heart surgery in terms of male ego and psyche and things like that.
Look, I think you could do a better job supporting this family.
I say she holds things back. I will not do the laundry until you get a better job.
What if he does the laundry, Dan? What if we're out of the 50s?
Then she can get a better job. You'll stay home. Everybody's happy.
What if the milkman doesn't deliver that day, too? It'll be the worst day ever.
Buvo, what's your marriage advice?
I'm kind of mixed because I think that we're generalizing dudes in and of itself. I think that there are certain ways that you can say to your husband in a way that's just, hey, sweetie, you have a really crappy job, and you need to get a better one because you're better than that. It has to be the certain right kind of guy. I think someone can go up to Mike and say that, and he'll go, okay, that's understandable.
Yeah.
You think that I'm not making enough money, and I need to make more, and I can. Let's do this. That's presenting the logic. If someone just came up to me and said that, though, I think I'm a different kind of guy than Mike is. I would take offense to that. I really would.
Okay, here. Oh, sorry.
I'm holding back everything I can not to categorize that, man. Go ahead.
Oh, that's fine.
I didn't mean to cut you off. Were you done?
Go ahead. What they really need to do is sit down and have a conversation, go over the budget and say, here, we have two options. We need to cut spending or make more money. What do you suggest? And you can reason it out together and have an adult conversation.
Yeah.
But something's got to change. You can't go on.
No, that's true. But there's a distinction like approaching that conversation as the wife saying, here's what we're going to do versus, hey, man,
how are we going to do this?
This is our thing, right? This is our life. This is our marriage. This is our finances.
We got six kids. We got to feed them.
Yeah. What are we going to do about that? And like when you both come to that decision, look at your options, come to that decision. That's a way better outcome than, hey, I think you just need to get another job.
Yeah.
Or hey, you know, I don't think you're working to your best advantage, and we're suffering. Oh yeah, that's a conversation starter.
Hey, failure.
I feel like I would get moving after that conversation. I'm just wired different than y'all. There we go. Here's what Segular says. It says, change tactics. What you consider helpful encouragement may be regarded by your husband as constant nagging about a sore subject. He's kind of a daisy.
Here's the deal, Mike. What? Here's it. Do you want to accomplish the thing? You want to get the job done, or do you want to be right in the way that you approach it?
I didn't say you don't have to give one or the other.
What I'm saying is like you seem to be leaning on the fact that like I get to approach this how I want to, and if you don't respect that, you're a pansy face.
I didn't say that.
That's how Buva represented you.
I didn't say that at all. I just said I would go the direct route because I feel like it's honest.
Okay. And then the other dude's a daisy. People,
tell me when you ever give the advice to trick a guy and shine it on like it's something it ain't. I would rather just have it straight out.
No, I think you tell. It's not that you're not telling the truth. It's not trickery.
Then what is the difference between what you're saying and what I'm saying?
One is saying let's solve this together. The second one is, hey, I've pondered this a lot. I've decided you're wrong. Change your ways.
Also not what I said. What you're imagining me is walking into a room, kicking over a vase, and telling people how it is. And that is not – that's not what I said at all.
That's exactly what you want to do, though.
I just said be straightforward and honest. That's all.
That's not how Buva painted it.
No. That's not how I took that at all. I took it as you're walking in boots to a vase.
Because you're a daisy.
See what I mean? I knew it was going to come out eventually.
Why does honesty always have to be brutal and mean? Why is not honesty considered the virtue that it is? Just because I'm telling the truth about something doesn't mean I have to sugarcoat it in flowers and whispers.
No. That's true. Your yes should be a yes, right? He didn't say say it maybe, but mean yes. Agree.
Yeah, I didn't say hands on hips, you know. Rooster are going. I just said, just say, hey, here's the deal. And then just say it honestly.
Yeah.
I suppose when I hear your phrase going direct and logical,
I'm thinking you walking in and be like, here's the situation. Here's what you need to fix.
I didn't say it how I'd say it. I just said say it truthfully.
No, but the point of case, though, based upon his own explanation, Bouvet is kind of a sensitive fella.
Yeah.
So he took what was a normal reaction and otherwise took it to heart.
Probably.
And then he folded a napkin across his lap and kept talking.
I probably did.
Hey, man, just because I like to look nice when I'm eating doesn't mean y'all got to call me a daisy. I can still lift more than both of you combined. Leave me alone. Let's paint some false masculinity in here and say I can lift more than you. Leave me alone.
I can't talk about this anymore. My Norwex order is due.
Now, it can still be honest, even if it isn't blunt. So there are ways of delivering it.
I did not say blunt. Okay. I just said honest.
Yeah. Okay. I'm with you. Be honest.
All right.
Yeah. Mike, we agree. Be honest.
I was.
Maybe none of us are honest until we get mad. Okay. And we're interpreting it through that filter.
Oh. Yeah. Well, I suggest you change your ways then.
Kick a base.
Here we go. Secular continues by saying, tell him you love him. I don't mean to pressure you. And if you see some ads seeking men with his skills that offer a higher salary, let him know about them.
No, don't do that.
That's what I would do.
That's passive aggressive.
Yeah. That is. Hide it under his pillow. Yeah.
That is exactly what I said not to do, and Bouva was all for.
Yeah.
Come up with some kind of life called Jenga with a bunch of weird moves in it and unbalanced. Straightforward. Candyland. Here we go. Dear Life from the Path, our future son-in-law recently moved in with us for financial reasons. He's 27 and a nice guy, but he's a habitual knuckle cracker. He cracks every finger of each hand twice, back and forth, every half hour or so. He also cracks his neck and wrists, but less frequently. As an added bonus, my daughter is also beginning to crack her knuckles now. I am sensitive to noise, loud chewing, gum cracking, but I don't want to cause him more stress. He's also a nail biter, so I keep my mouth shut. It's driving me crazy. What do you suggest?
Get a hold of a reality show.
I don't
know. Go ahead, Bouva. Write him a letter. Ask him how his day's going. Then explain noise sensitivity to him.
But do it in poetry. Here.
Let me take the Mike Foosh way to do this, all right? You grab that guy by the back of the shirt, you throw him out of the house, and then tell him until he stops cracking his knuckles, he's not allowed back in.
I would make him a knuckle-cracking booth. Say, look, if you're going to keep this up... I would build a box with insulation in it and two of those gloves.
Do it in here.
And then say, look, if you're going to keep doing that, you're driving me and the dog nuts. I'm going to need you to put your hands in this isolation booth I made. Crack away.
Here's the deal. I don't think there's anything inappropriate about saying, hey, man, that knuckle cracking driving me nuts, man. And then he said, here's the deal. It's like, you're going to chop off his hand for cracking his knuckles. But like
only because it's illegal.
He doesn't have the right to crack his knuckles anywhere he wants to. Like, he can't stand next to this like somebody that works at the Walmart doing the checkout line and just kind of stand by their head. And, you know what I'm saying? Like that's not your right to do whatever you want to do. So like it's completely legit to say, hey man, that really bothers me. Can you do that somewhere else?
Some people don't even notice they're doing it.
That's like, what I'm saying. I don't think he even knows he's doing it.
I do it in second nature. If someone were to say to me, hey, that's really driving me nuts. Can you please stop doing that? I'd be like, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize I was doing that. That was annoying you.
I mean, have a conversation with him.
It's kind of a
sign of a pretty high-stress dude anyway. Like, he might need some – I mean, I'm not saying to look past the baseline of his life to say that a guy that habitually does any action over and over and over again is usually a bit stressed out if it's not for some other reason. But Yeah, I'd build him a box. I'd say, listen, you're gonna need to tone that down, or I'm gonna build you a box, and then I'd fall through with it.
And then I'd build me a box.
Because I'm honest.
I'd build that box right then. I would.
Okay. Have a conversation.
Here's what Secular says. Secular says, knuckle cracking, like nail biting, is a nervous habit that has been known to diffuse anxiety. While it may be crazy making to listen to, unless it's a symptom of an underlying nervous disorder, the practice is relatively harmless. Not the question they asked. In some people, it has caused swelling of the joints or swelling of the hands, so mention that to your daughter. Because you are sensitive to noises, which your daughter should already know, talk to her and her fiancé and ask that when the impulse strikes, they walk out of earshot. Because they are living under your roof, they should respect your request.
Oh, man, it's going to be awkward, though, especially if he's got a problem. Like every 3 or 4 minutes, he gets up and he walks to the kitchen, crack, 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 and then walks back in.
Yeah, here's what I think is really going on. She's gotten older, and her hearing's kind of bad, and she doesn't know she's passing gas regularly. She can't hear it.
Wow.
And he's so full of anxious, and he's so full of anxiety. He's cracking his knuckles in response, and it's just a big circular thing. They need to move out. They need to get married and move out.
Yeah. Wind and cracking.
Yeah, actually,
That's what keeps happening. Sounds awful.
You get yourself an apartment, you can crack them knuckles all you want, buddy.
That's right.
You sure can.
People can turn the TV right up. Ain't no problems. You can even take the box I made with you in case people, you know, are upset about it. Here we go, last one. Well, maybe not last one. Dear Life from the Path, I have a small home-based business making baking extracts
that I sell at our local farmer's market. Occasionally, a patron will look over my stock and ask me how I make them. I'm unsure how to answer that question in a way that is not a negative impact on future sales. Baking extracts are not difficult to make, but the process is time-consuming and the ingredients are expensive. I don't want to give away the details of my production process, yet I don't know how to say that without seeming rude. Any ideas?
Humor.
Wait, I don't understand the basic question.
Secret family recipe.
She makes baking extracts, sells them at the farmer's market. A guy says, hey, how do you do that? And she doesn't want to tell him because she thinks he's going to go home and make baking extracts.
Say it's a company secret.
Say secret family recipe.
Claim to be a wizard. Like, there's a million options here.
Say that there was an old lady who told you and then made you swear that if you ever told anybody, you would forget it.
So you would lie. All the direct and honest approaches that we had in the previous questions, you've given up on.
Yeah, yeah. I met
for a bunch of honky.
I met a witch in the forest, and she said, mend the ties that bind. And then I got this recipe.
I got a card with this recipe in it.
You can claim that you bought an extractor from the internet. It does all the work for you.
Break the bond. Seal your fate. What's that? What am I thinking of? It's a cartoon. Ah, crap. Never mind. I don't know what to talk about Jesus
on the net.
That's
great, Ben.
Sorry.
Good stuff.
Yeah. Well, okay, so the truth is to say,
we should probably leave.
I don't think you need to get all serious about it. The truth is my business runs upon this recipe, and if I were to give it to you, I got troubles.
I didn't say that stuff.
So I think I'm claiming to be a wizard is just fine.
What's your thought, Mike?
I would say no.
How did you make this? No.
She said they didn't want it to affect future sales. I feel like if you're just flat out saying no.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, you know, I really love these. You know, what do you do to make these so amazing? Yeah, nothing. Yeah. There's not a lot that goes into it, but I'm not going to tell you what that not a lot is.
Say. I'm not going to tell you that.
Yeah. No, I'm not here. Love the existential bakery.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry, I can't
come to the phone right now. I'd like to leave your name, number, and
the other guys
message.
At the farmer's market, like, how'd you grow that corn? Well, I put corn in the ground, and then, whoop, it came up, and I sold it to you. No doubt. I'm going to grow my own corn.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably, I can think of, you know, within a few minutes, 10 folksy sayings to not tell them,
but
say something witty.
Yeah.
How do you make that?
Well,
90% hard work, 10% magic.
Maybe they're not gifted
magic.
In the wit department. Exactly. They're asking for your advice.
There's a little flour, there's a little eggs, and a lot of love.
Here's what we're going to do. Everyone has to pump out one witty saying. Ben Fusco, hold on. I will ask the question. How do you make those baking extracts?
90% ingredients, 10% love, 5% magic.
First off.
All right, if you don't want to tell me, you just say so. Booba.
Hey, man. You kind of stole some of mine. That wasn't cool.
I know. It was awesome.
I felt really good about that.
Good luck.
Just say it's a secret family recipe.
But what if it isn't?
Past it. It sure isn't 5% love.
Actually, he was 90% something, 10% love, 5% magic.
Okay, fine. Then it's definitely not 5% magic, but you're calling me out. It's a secret family recipe?
All right.
Really?
Is that what you're saying? It's a secret family recipe?
Secret family.
You want to follow that up with a wink or something?
Yeah. It's a secret family recipe. That's what you got.
All right, Herrick, what's your witty retort?
I buy it from the guy who's three stalls over, and I sell it, and I just sell it for a lower price because I'm bad at business.
Okay, I like Herrick's. Dan?
If I told you, I'd have to kill you.
Classic, Dan.
Yeah, all right, creepy. CIA style.
Mine is no.
No. That wasn't witty at all. You just said no.
Yeah, I only need so many customers. You know what I'm saying? I'm making a good living. If I lose a guy, I don't think I'm that worried about it. Answer's no.
All right. I think that's fair.
What does secular say?
Hang on a minute. Secular says, smile at the questioner and reply. That would be giving away trade secrets, but I can share one of them. I make them all with love.
Yes.
Yep, there you go.
No, you didn't say what? That. I said it. Love and magic?
Right.
Or it's halfway to a Red Hot Chili Peppers album.
I was going to say, we're missing something for an RCP album.
You want to do one more?
Yeah.
All right, dear life from the past. Uh-oh. I'm a 12-year-old girl, and my grandpa is 75. I love him very much, but I have noticed lately that he stares a lot at ladies while they're jogging, and he smiles when a gust of wind blows his skirt up. This embarrasses me, and I'm embarrassed for him. He must have realized it by now. Is my grandpa a creepy, dirty old man? I hope it's not true. Please answer this in the newspaper, because I don't want my family to see it.
How often is this happening?
I don't know.
I mean, here's the deal. I'm not creeping town for it, I guess, but like, I can't recall a time where I've ever seen a lady running by and a breeze caught her skirt, and I smiled.
Yeah, you don't spend all day in a park, though, watching joggers go by.
Was that the impression that he sits there all day?
He didn't say all day, but says he smiles at ladies as the joggers as they go by.
I didn't know joggers wore skirts.
How stiff of a breeze? Where's she living,
Seattle?
I think
he's staring at the second floor with the joggers.
Oh.
I don't know. Okay. All right. So advice.
But he is creepy, yes.
Yeah, he's a creeper.
Yep.
And say, I think Grandpa, you disgust me.
Yeah.
As a woman, a soon-to-be woman, a growing woman, whatever, don't do that. It's
now, hold on. To be fair, I saw an old man today. He was sitting in front of a hospital. And I walked by and talked to him, and that guy hadn't been smiling for the last 45 minutes. I mean, he's just sitting outside smiling. Some people just do that.
Okay, right. I was with a group of older guys once at a golf country club, whatever thing, and it was in the second floor, and they were looking down out the window into the pool, and they were all gawking about something. Uh-huh. And I walked up. I didn't know the pool was there, and I walked up, and they were like, oh, look at that. And it's like there's a couple, three girls on their bikinis. And I was like, guys, honestly, I think I'm going to throw up. I mean, it was just gross. They're all in their 70s. The girls are in their teens or turn 20s. I don't know.
How did they react to it?
They're just like, I mean, just, you know,
wow.
Look at us. We're old men. You know, it's just
they
like,
can't get away with a lot, though.
Yeah. It's like, this just seems a little inappropriate. Yeah, but they can't see us. Like,
yeah, you know.
Yeah, he's creepy.
Yeah, he's definitely.
It was creepy.
He was definitely creepy. And I think I'd hope that if one of my kids noticed that about one of their grandpas, they would tell me. You know, and I could probably have a conversation with my dad.
Yeah, I can't imagine and say, talking to my grandfather in a way that's just like, hey, Grandpa Joe, you're creepy. Yeah. We should probably stop that. Stop looking at ladies.
Okay, let's see what Secular has to say about this.
Hey, that cartoon was brave.
Okay, thanks, man.
Tell you the fuel defeat.
What? Secular says, I'm sorry, but the fact that your grandfather would be so unsubtle as to act this way when you're with him is creepy, and I'm sure it is embarrassing. Tell your parents about it so your mother or father can call him to tell him to tone it down his enthusiasm. And if it doesn't happen, just spend less time with Grandpa.
I don't know. Is there any possibility that, like, it happened once and she's painted him with broad strokes?
No. Probably
not. No.
Like
I mean, yeah, possible yes, probably.
Is once too many around your granddaughter?
Well,
exactly.
I'm just saying, like, that seems a lot of coincidences to have. I've never seen a breeze hit someone like that, ever. I've never seen that.
And he's been watching closely.
It had to happen while she was there and caught him a peeping. Like, I don't care if you're, I mean, maybe he sits all day at the park and peeps, but the opportunity where such a stiff breeze is blowing up skirts that she represents that it happened multiple times, it just seems slightly implausible to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Hey, you're listening to Life in the Path. Thanks for hanging us out with us so far. You can catch more of the show during the week by going to lifeinthepath.org. Clips from the show, past interviews, musical performances, and sign up for the audio podcast. And if you're hanging out with us on KTA, we got to let you go. If you're on the audio podcast, give us just, 20, 30 seconds. We'll be right back with you. Thanks for listening to Life in the Path. I forgot about one other thing that I was mad on Facebook this week. I gotta get off Facebook.
I've done it. It's fantastic.
I've blocked all those people, so I don't see that stuff.
Facebook misses you, Mike.
No, don't.
I should have wrote down better notes, but I was reading I can't remember what spurned this. But it was some sort of deterioration in the church. I think it just had to do with basically, do people teach truth in the pulpit? Okay, I think that was the basic nature of the conversation. And here's this guy's quotation on how this got there. Okay, he says it starts with the music program. The old hymn books are put away in favor of chanting and hand waving. Then the denomination is dropped from the church name on the outside of the building. Then the clothing standards are dropped. Just come as you are. God doesn't need your best. Next comes the coffee bar in the lobby. No church on Sunday evening, replaced by cottage ministries. No church on Wednesdays. No bus ministries. No visitation. Before you know it, your pastor is a transsexual female. And, And God is long gone.
This guy's a 50s Baptist.
Holy cats!
Never recovered.
Wow.
I can't think of a longer list of crap that I don't really care about.
Bus ministry. Oh, no!
They park the bus. Jesus dies. I don't get it.
Holy cats.
And he still hates Footloose.
There'll be no dancing in my town.
Hey, now, that used to rule, all right? In the 80s, that was the common thought.
Yeah.
My generation helped usher in this pancakes, powder puff stuff that you see now. We just kind of went too far. Some of the stuff he might have, not in what he's saying, but a lot of churches have watered stuff down and afraid to offend people because they need the numbers and they need the people and they have these big buildings and big salaries and they can't offend people. They'll stop coming.
He's described a list of symptoms that is completely irrelevant as to whether you teach truth or not.
Right.
Like, that's the deal, right?
He's remembering the good old days, and that's some of the stuff that went along with it with him.
Yeah. Like, and I get it. Just like I take, obviously, a high view of Scripture. You should be teaching truth from the pulpit. If you're not, I don't know what you're doing. Like, you're not a pastor. You're just a wandering guy that somehow could convince someone to give you a microphone. What I found odd about it, because like you run into guys like this, but like what I found odd about it was like there isn't like one thing in here that I was like, yeah, he's hit the nail on the head. Like everything was peripheral and pretty stupid.
Yeah.
Like I can find a church that doesn't have a hymnal that still loves Jesus. I can find a church that does not drop the denomination. That's our problem. The thing that glorifies the splits in the church.
Yeah,
and it's like, boy, we're really running wrong now for having dropped that from the name.
When he was talking, when you were giving off the list, I'm like, are you reading the right list? Because these all sound like proves to me. You know what I'm saying? The domination thing gone, bus ministry. I'm not supposed they're kind of helpful, but I mean, like, I don't know. A person-to-person relationship feel like it does a lot more.
Here's the deal. We got this thing where we call everything ministry. It's not a bus ministry. You drive a bus. You pick people up and you take them to church. That's a solid activity. But it's not like it's not a ministry. Like
it's
just
a form of transportation.
It's what we do, and that's fine.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, I was thinking about that the other day. Why do people do that? Why do they call it we'll call it we do it here. We call it the cafe ministry. Like I was born through sweet Jesus to cafe.
And but just the idea of you're serving Jesus. It's a ministry.
I think I understand what you're saying, but why do we do that? Why do we call it that? Right? Like what's wrong with calling it? Hey, I just go out. Why do you even call it a ministry? Right? Like what's the grand
purpose? Is there a sense of saying we have a bus service or we have a bus ministry?
Or I feed the homeless. We don't call it a homeless ministry. We're just like, hey, we go down and talk to people. That's it. Like, is it because we have hard times getting people involved in it if we don't call it something?
Well, it raises it just a hair, right? Like it notches it up a little bit by giving, identifying it as a ministry. It makes it feel like it has more value.
And it's intentional.
Right. But the problem is like it implicitly has the value that it has. Regardless of what you call it, right?
Right, right.
And the thing is like when you call it, maybe we run a risk by having so many of those things that we call a ministry that it feels like an activity as opposed to a way that you live, right? Like as opposed to having a homeless ministry, do you serve homeless people?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? As opposed to having a ministry when you get ministries, you get groups of people, you get times to meet, you get specific ways of doing something as opposed to do you live that way?
Yeah, if you're in the homeless ministry, you feed people. If you're not, you can walk by the homeless guy and think, hey, the homeless ministry folks will get it.
Yeah, and they, people even use that broadly just with the broad term ministry. Oh, I'm not in the ministry, so I don't do this or that. Or and so there probably is some level of to try to get people involved and understand the impact that these daily things can have. You call it a ministry to try to communicate the right thing. And then at some point, you probably get satiated to the extent that now, because you've called it that thing, now it seems distinct and an activity as opposed to just a way of living.
Well, I think that, that's the rubber band coming back after you pulled it too far. Too far and coming back would be to say, look, stop calling things ministries, right? You're pumping them up more than they are. Just live the life and don't call things ministries, right? That's a bit too far. But I think what I was kind of getting at is, like, I mean, you should be able to follow a guy that loves Christ around all day and find out that he's involved in like 1,000 ministries, right? Like, he's a nice guy ministry. He tells the truth ministry. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's kind to people ministry. He cares for others. He loves his wife. He takes care of it. He reads the Bible to his kids ministry. You know what I'm saying? Like, you should be able to find people that love Jesus doing all kinds of ministry without calling it a darn thing.
You know, just calling it a guy that loves Jesus. That's it.
Right. And the point is that the name itself is irrelevant, right? Like the you could call it whatever you want to. People are going to react. This is where you run into risk when you're trying to, as a church, try to figure out what people think and try to market something to try to get them to latch on to it. Maybe if you change the name, maybe if you do something differently. Yeah. Like, what happens is like, first of all, you're chasing real fickle people who do weird things, right? Mm-hmm. Who knows the mind of these guys? The guy that sells Coke seems to have a good handle on it. Everyone else stinks.
Yeah.
And second of all, they change. Like, they're not consistent people. And then, like, what you're doing as the shepherds, you're chasing the sheep around, mm-hmm. trying to see what they want. And sometimes we get caught up in trying to figure out the best way to call something. Like, you should be able to call it a ministry, not call it a ministry. It's irrelevant. It ultimately doesn't matter. Do they understand what we're doing, why we do it, and how it should reflect in your day-to-day living, right? Yeah. And if they know those things, you could call it the Jump Fest. It doesn't matter what it is. But sometimes, like, because we've trained them with the way society appeals to them and the church has kind of followed suit, we've taught them to key off things. We've taught them to use words to kind of key in, I should believe a certain thing about this, or I should react to things in a certain way because of the language that they've used. And we're kind of just a part of that. And we've gotten to the part where we're kind of having to tussle around with those things all the time to try to keep people engaged with things when all of that discussion is irrelevant.
It is. But it's also easier to raise support and get people in the pews to volunteer and serve in something that has been branded as a ministry, because it's just easier for them to see this as a service to God instead of trying to actually develop a whole idea that everything you do is a service to God.
It moves the needle. It moves a needle faster.
Yeah, a needle. Right.
A needle. Whether it's the needle is the right question, right? Like, right. Did we help you accomplish a task that had a Jesus theme to it, or did we help you identify with a way to live in a kingdom that Jesus?
Right. Well, I mean, it's all branding. It has nothing to do with.
That is the exact opposite of what you were talking about sometimes the religious folks get upset because it's a Jesus guided principle, but doesn't have Christ's name attached to it. And we're talking about the exact opposite here. Like, we're attaching Christ's name to something and then going out and doing the good deed, you know, because Christ's name is attached to it. Like, it's almost the exact opposite.
Yeah. Anyway, I saw that guy and I thought, I hadn't seen anybody that had hit so many miscues that I thought, like, I feel like I would have nothing to talk about with this guy. And I love Jesus. And if I know another, it's like having a smoker, right? You find another guy that loves Jesus in random places, you got something you can chat about.
Hey, buddy.
And I'm just afraid that if me and this guy were standing outside of a cafe waiting for a cab or something, and we both mutually love Jesus, I still feel like I wouldn't have a lot to talk with him about.
Have you read Philippians? Well, I feel like the interpretation of Philippians from blah, 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 blah is the best one.
What did I miss, though? What's a cottage ministry? What does he mean?
Small groups.
Small, yeah, home groups.
Oh, that is offensive.
Yeah, no church on Sunday evening, replaced by cottage ministries.
Huh?
Don't forget, that's one of the things he was upset about. Hmm. Don't forget to gather, but he means in a very corporate way on a Sunday evening.
Hey, that used to be a battle. I mean, you would battle.
You'd be surprised how many of those points that you just read off.
Because he can't control people who's meeting in four houses.
Right.
He can control them if they're in this one room.
Well, that's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
That was the issue.
Got to control the message.
Next comes the coffee bar in the lobby.
Can't trust Jesus to brand himself.
The elders need to know what's going on in every crevice.
People are discussing the gospel on their own.
No.
Not in this town.
Not unless we authorize it. I've been in those battles, my friend.
Boy, that's rough times. It seems more foreign because, like, I think when I started getting into churches. At my age, we were coming off the tail end of that, right? So I didn't live in that as much as some people have.
No, that's true. It's almost like a cartoon to me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't believe it actually ever happened.
Yeah, like guys like this exist out there somewhere. Now, the thing is, he's probably reacting to something that he came in at the tail end when he was growing up that ended up, you know, clamping some of that stuff down, which was probably also an overreaction.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, there's to be fair to this guy, there's more – he's trying to protect something. In fact, almost everybody that I disagree with theologically is trying to protect something that they otherwise think is important. They're just protecting it in a wrong way or protecting something that God doesn't need protected from.
Yeah, essentially there's some kind of environment or program or some way in which he connected with God. And so to him, that's holy ground.
So
I can understand the need and the desire to protect it, but to defend holy ground and not – at the expense of inviting people to God, that's a crime.
I mean, no, and you know what? And this isn't quite the same example, but like I was thinking about this Sunday afternoon. So like we had we've been out of the communion wafer things, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so they had some oyster crackers there.
Yeah, I noticed that.
And so Dan and I were kind of talking a little bit about that stuff. And, like, and I'm, you know, we need to order some more wafers and stuff. I'm like, well, you know what? Does it really matter? Like, still, we're kind of past the unleavened part, right? Like, it's not the Passover anymore. And Dan's like, well, yeah, you know, let's just get the wafers, right? Like, it's
a, because it would be a big deal to some.
It would be a big deal to somebody about it. And like, I walked, and what I realized was, like, during that conversation is, it really doesn't matter. But if to the extent that it doesn't matter, I really don't care whether we get the friggin' leavened or the unleavened wafers. Like, I don't care. But like, but at the moment though, one of the things that I have that I'm kind of steeped in is like, tradition that is there for no reason. Like, it bothers me. But the truth is, if I don't care, I actually shouldn't care whether you do it the traditional way or the other way. And I was thinking about that on Sunday afternoon. I thought, like, there was I know where that came from, and I have to be careful about that. Like, just because some people have some things that are otherwise traditional, doesn't implicitly make them wrong. Don't idolize them. Don't worship them. Don't make them something that they're not. But, like, it also – there's no reason for it to bother me, right? And so, anyway, it was something that I thought of that, like, kind of on the other side of this guy where he may be he may be over traditional and putting things on a pedestal that don't belong there. Although some things don't belong on a pedestal, they're not wrong either. And the nature of not caring is to have the freedom to actually not care.
Yeah. So, I mean, we have no problem if someone wants to bust out the hymnals. That's fine.
Rock them. Sounds absolutely good. Actually, there was where did we go? We were at a kid's birthday party or something earlier this week, and they I grew up in the Baptist church, and like, man, I love me that Baptist hymnal. There's a lot of all kinds of cool songs that I really, really like and that I miss. And I forgot. I had one at home. I went and found it. And, I just love those songs. There's nothing wrong with them or anything. Mm-hmm. Like, who cares how they're bound or published or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah. Anyway.
It's funny because that guy, representative of that idea of ministry, a guy I battled and some of these issues that brought in all the evil stuff that he's worried about. I mean, when he had a heart attack and was in the hospital, potentially dying, his wife made sure to call me and say, don't come visit him.
Holy buckets.
Yeah. Whoa.
That's pretty fierce.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like, you'll push him over the rest of the edge, you know? Like, all right.
Oh, wow.
Man.
I mean, that's how serious it is.
What a toxic environment.
Oh, very toxic.
I mean, seriously.
Yeah. It was sad. It broke my heart for them. I mean, I didn't care. It's like, okay, hey, here's a trip I don't need to take. But, you know, I was like, wow, to be that.
That jaded with things.
Yeah.
Things that Jesus didn't care about. Like, upset with what ultimately Jesus simply doesn't seem to care about.
So actually, I lied. She called a guy who called me.
Oh.
She wouldn't talk to me.
Wasn't
either.
Even a direct phone call.
Yeah, it wasn't even a direct call. Yeah.
Oh, man, that's rough.
Holy cats. Here's the thing. Like, there's more of that that goes on than I even know about. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't attend that church. I'm generally not around those people. Like, and so I, you know, it's just such a foreign. In fact, a guy at work I was talking to a guy about Christ a couple weeks ago, whatever, and he was explaining to me why he doesn't go to church, and it was kind of like that kind of story, you know, and it had a bunch of weird, non important things in there, and I'm like, what are you even talking? What church did you go to?
Like, yeah, yeah.
Now I'm furious. Like, I want to know the name of the guy because I'm gonna call him and say, what are you doing? You're acting like a fool.
The communion thing, I'm actually extremely impressed. Has it been 3 weeks or four or whatever that we've had these things? I've not heard a single thing.
That's impressive.
Very impressive to me because there's a segment that grew up going, you can't, I mean.
You can't do this.
You can't do this. And most people are pretty understanding in a mobile church setting. Is like, I mean, we don't have a stockpile of communion bread.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
In the cabinet. We have whatever's in a tote on a trailer, you know. And, anyway, I was actually quite impressed with that. But I'm fairly sure if we kept going, at some point, some of us say, hey, when are we doing the real
Where's
stuff?
Where's the holy crackers? These crackers appear very secular.
That we buy from a corporation that sends them in a box.
Very expensively. So I'm thinking we make our own now that we have our own place.
I've been, but lately, over the last, I don't know, 4 to 6 months, like, I've been really, I've been really drawn to the loaves. Like people taking from, like, that's just the more, it's the clearer picture, right, of what community is. Like, I get it, there's health things, people don't want to take loaves. Yes. But, like, I don't know, that's your community gathering, right? I don't know.
If you're going to do loaves, then I'm going to post myself outside the bathroom and say, nope, get in there.
I've left communion services before because I was creeped out. I wasn't sure how they're going to do it because they had, like, big chunks of bread and one glass. I was like, I don't even know what they're going to do. Like exponential.
Oh, yeah.
And then I actually did it a couple years later, and they just, like, dipped the bread and ate it. I thought, well, that wasn't so gross, but...
Yeah.
Can you do that? You combine the two?
I thought it was kind of weird.
It's one delivery?
I've seen them.
Hmm. I think I went to a mass one time where they were all drinking out of the same cup, and I just had no idea what was going to happen. We were standing in line.
I'm unspiritual. I'd be just like, no, thank you.
Oh, and everyone's, like, tipping this fancy cup. I'm like, he's going to spill it on me. Like, and then the guy right in front of me, like, coughed a couple times and then took a drink. I'm like, isn't there some kind of onus on you not to come up here?
On your lip there?
Drinky.
Yeah, here's the deal.
Seriously, dude.
Poor sanitary practices aren't implicitly holy just because you think that's how it occurred when Jesus was there.
I don't think that water at the front of the door does what you think it does. Yeah. Like, you're unclean. Stop coughing into that communion cup. It's disgusting.
I could get on board with a guy with like a full loaf of bread and somebody that with like some glove, like a nice glove or something that kind of tore off pieces and gave you
a nice glove. A holy glove.
I mean, I don't want to put it where
a holy white glove.
I don't want to wear a gardening gloves or something like that'd be a little awkward.
He should wear a butler outfit. We will call him glove? Jeeves.
We bought it from Michael's.
Jeeves, do you have the gloves on yet?
Would you like the heels, sir? Hey, I'm part of the glove ministry. I'm here to work.
Red or white.
Can someone in the bus ministry come pick me up?
Actually, so like we kind of shifted some of that stuff around our church recently, and like the number of ministries we have is extremely small. Like they're groups, they're communities, right? They do what they want to do, they function how they want to function within the realms of like, I don't know, don't be a heretic and love Jesus. Like those are kind of our standards. Outside of that, like our ministries are things things that the church will control, which means that like if it stopped happening and no one else was passionate about it, we would still have to find someone to do it. Mm-hmm. But like outside of that, it's pretty much people do where their passions are taking them and they get on board. And if it perpetuates, sweet. If not, like, because the minute you call something a ministry, you're kind of committed to have to like keep it rolling. You can't fire up a bus ministry, right? And then like a year later, like leave all these 10 people that you were picking up
because
we decided to stop driving the bus. Yeah. Sorry, Betty, Jesus doesn't love you enough. Like, good luck with that. You better make sure you're willing to keep that thing around.
Isn't that the reason that a lot of churches have taken up controls of those ministries because people aren't passionate about jack nothing?
Well,
and they don't do anything.
Well, yeah. So I think that it gets a lot worse before it gets better, right? You feel the pain of because when you create a bunch of ministries, one of the things it does. Is like then the church perpetuates it, right? You find people to do it. You scout people. You bring them in. You try to convince them to do it. They tell you they're going to pray on it because everyone does. And then they come back and they say, oh, yes, the Lord's leading me to do it. Like, I don't know. Maybe he's not. So, but that's what happens. You create an institution and then you grab people to fill it. And so what happens is when you start to strip that down, like it hurts for a while. And frankly, it starts to get depressing because like once you stop propping things up, people just stop doing things, right? They stop doing these things that you've propped up. But what it is actually a clearer picture of where people are actually at, right? Because if you're, if the whole center of your ministries, of the work that you do as a church is founded upon the things that your staff or your elders have created and are drafting people into, like you run a risk that they're doing it because you're telling them to do it. Like they're not actually doing it for the right reasons, with the right heart, and not accomplishing the right things. They're doing your tasks, right? As opposed to like actually making disciples, which shouldn't feel like a task. But then once you strip it all down and then you start to rebuild it back up, what actually happens is if you can lay the right foundation where people start to realize the things that they're passionate, gifted in, and they want to serve Christ in those things, that's naturally way more attractive to grab people into. It doesn't feel like, hey, come join my task. It's like, hey, be part of my passion. Be part of the thing that God has called me to do. And you're excited for it. And even when things don't go well, you're still excited for it. You don't walk away. You don't get stressed out and leave, right? Because that's what God has with you, and you're jazzed for that. Helping people – now, here's the deal. It's like you correct too far if you just say, sheep do. Because sheep don't just do, right? You still have to help that process. You have to help them nurture that, figure out how to use those gifts, how to organize those things and how to use those to the glory of God. Like, you still have to do that. So an overreaction is to cut everything, all infrastructure. But, like, if you start with the right infrastructure that is based upon what people do, then you're not chasing people around. And you're not in a – let's say one guy comes in and he loves tennis, and he fires up a tennis thing. And then, like, he leaves the church 3 years later, and then you're trying to, like, prop up this tennis deal for another 4 years because you don't want it to die because it feels like a failure. It's a failure if tennis ministry doesn't succeed because there's three people straggling who've been there for 5 years, right? But like if passionate tennis guy runs a tennis deal and for Jesus, that's awesome. And then if he has to leave, He parts. And if someone doesn't want to take it up, it goes away because the guy that was leading it is gone. And like if he's touched 5 or 10 people, then one of those guys will want to step up and keep it. If it hasn't, if it wasn't functioning in that way, then it dies. And that's all right. There's no reason to mourn it. It went away because the guy that was passionate about it left. But other people are passionate about other things. So that's where I think you if you cut down to what you have to have, and then like you help people see it as an extension of who they are, of their lifestyle, as opposed to here's the infrastructure that the church has put in place, mold to that. Like that's not using the gifts God has given them. And so you're better off doing that, but you also can't just let it go. Like you do have to help people do that because they are still sheep.
Yep.
All right. Anyway, that's enough about harassing that guy on Facebook. I got to get it. You've been off the Facebook for a week, bud?
Couple weeks. And almost 3.
It's straight up all right.
Yeah, I check it.
You seem a little wiser.
I check it, on the webpage or whatever. I'll check it out once or twice a week, maybe just to make sure I didn't miss anything heavy at the church that I'm missing out on.
Crack your knuckles less?
Then I crack my knuckles, and then I make a lot of noise. But, like, seriously, it's been literally fantastic. Like, I forget my phone place is kind of fantastic. Usually, I'm like, I don't get more than 5 feet away from my phone. I'm like, where's my phone? The kids got my phone. I can't find my phone. You know, and I've literally left it and lost it a couple times in the last 3 weeks because I don't care about Facebook. And it's really a relief. I mean, it's fantastic. The people that know me, that need something from me, call me. I text message. I actually call people that I need to talk to instead of sending them some kind of trite, you know, message on the Facebook. I'm ecstatic about it. I'm very happy.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I'm not saying Facebook don't have its places, but like, I don't know. It's really
kind of dwindled, I think.
It's just been a huge weight off. You know what I mean? I literally, you don't have that many friends, Dan. You know what I'm saying? You have a lot of acquaintances.
A lot of people that want to tell me how to think politically.
Forget it.
I blocked those.
But, you know, but that's the thing, Eric, though. Like, why even keep up the charade, right? Why have them as a friend and then block them?
No, I mean, I don't friend them.
Oh, you just unfriend people?
Yeah.
I think Mike has a series of people on his that is, that are people he still has as friends, but otherwise blocks.
Oh, yeah. There's a ton of them.
That's selfish.
I've got a few of them. I hide them. I guess I don't block them. I hide them.
No, actually, I tried to figure out, like, if I unfriend somebody, does it send a message and say you're unfriended?
No, but if they pull you up, it'll say
friend. Well, that's too bad, because that's how I'd want it to go down. Yeah, I don't want to, because it seems kind of daisy-ish to me to be like, I secretly don't look at your stuff no more. I'd be like, listen, I don't appreciate what you're doing. We're done now. You know, like, there's a couple of people that I had as friends, and I'm like, I don't know. I feel stressful just to know you. Like, and they were Jesus folks, you know, but like, man, just the nonstop, they were just mad about stuff all the freaking time.
This guy said the wrong word in 1972. You listen to his sermons?
Yeah.
I don't want to get caught up in their war. I
mean, no.
I've got my own battles.
I mean, seriously, I get it. You don't like Obama, okay? I got it. You don't like him. Done.
Yeah.
No. You know, why don't you just write it one time? I don't much care. For Obama.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't vote for it. I wouldn't do it again.
That's right.
Love me. Yeah, it's good.
And instead they find some kind of news article where he like burns hats and the hat society's mad at him and like, can you believe this outrage? He burns hats now. Oh, well.
I still don't like him.
I had no idea that he was a hat burner.
This has like, reinforced everything I ever thought.
There's a picture of Pat Robertson's bathroom rug. Is this disgusting or what? I'm like, I don't care. Jeez.
I don't know why Pat Robertson's bathroom rug made me think of this. But, like, I think we should stop using the phrase pearly gates. Because in Revelation, like, it's not a gate made of multiple pearls. Like, it describes it as a giant pearl.
Right.
It's just a pearl.
That'd be awesome. Samson, move the pearl. All right.
I mean,
Samson, put it back.
Actually, so when we were going through the Revelation class, I never felt so robbed because I read this pearly gate thing. I'm like, this has been explained incorrectly. Like, it has given me a false sense of what this is, right? And first of all, it makes it sound like there's an entrance, kind of a double gate, probably a wrought iron with some pearls kind of on the outside.
You've
of
seen
it.
Seen too many comic strips.
Or carved out a pearl, yeah.
It goes, get me the best wrought iron.
This is like a single pearl. It's like I imagine it looks a lot like those pods in Metroid. You guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, because that's what I think it looks like, these gates. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
So anyway.
Hey, now, that would be awesome. You Metroid your way in there.
Resurrected body goes.
You know, it's just like when people like to say that, like, there's appearances of Christ in the Old Testament. He's also inserted his pearly gates in Metro. Here's what we're going to do. Whoop.
Only way to get into heaven is 5 missiles.
The Christophany of Metroid. That sounds awesome. Work on it, Eric. I feel like that's up your alley.
All right.
Appearances of Christ in modern video gaming.
You can also play Excitebike as a grown man.
You can build your own track in the shape of a cross.
Hey, I got a quick question for you before we split out of here.
Okay.
So you know how plants give off oxygen, right?
Yeah.
What happens in the wintertime?
Most of them die.
That's what I'm saying. Is there less oxygen in the winter?
No.
Well, it's not always winter everywhere.
I'm talking about like at my house. Like if my house is surrounded by trees and the trees is doing all the filtering and putting out oxygen. And then my daughter asked me this question. I was dumbfounded and I felt like a fool. And I said, I don't know. So if the green is what's putting out the oxygen and all the leaves are gone, is there less oxygen at my house in the winter?
The atmosphere will circulate around the air in, like, a matter of days.
What do you mean?
Like over the course of a week, the air that's over here can find its way over to the other side of the Earth. So, at any given point, there is some part of the Earth that's experiencing summer or direct sunlight.
So my trees are inconsequential.
And oceans have algae?
Your trees will hibernate.
Yeah,
there's oceans of algae. There's the equator that is always tropical, which that's where most of the oxygen is actually produced is... in the equatorial tropical whatever forests.
So it sounds like there is. I would agree with both of those items. A large amount of photosynthesis comes from algae in the oceans and the taiga forest in the North Pole.
Mm-hmm.
However, land-based photosynthesis is in the northern hemisphere, and there is a seasonal variation in carbon dioxide levels during the wintertime.
Don't you have houseplants?
No.
By how much?
8 parts per million.
Okay.
Or less.
I can feel it.
Yeah.
That's enough to stop my toenail growth, at least. I was wondering what was happening in the wintertime.
I blame the furnace.
You're listening to Live from the Path on livefromthepath.org, broadcasting every Monday night from, I don't even know. I don't even know what time it is. The Black Cave of Johnston. Check out the podcast. You can subscribe to that on the website. You can also check out past YouTube clips of bands, guests we've had in. We're going to really ramp up the amount of cool folks that are coming in this studio, just frankly, because we have room for them.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be cool. We're going to try to get some bands in here. In fact, if you have some people you'd like to see on the show, even if it's yourself, just shoot us an email at info@livefromthepath.org.
Yeah, heck, man. Hey, I'd like to come on. I think we could probably do that.
I mean, you listen to the show tonight. We got a very low filtering process. Really just want to make sure that you're not actively killing a man right now.
Yeah.
And if you can pass that test, in you come.
Don't bring a man that you are in the process of killing, robbing, or whatever into the studio with you.
Yeah, actually, if you're considering that, why don't you come here instead?
But don't bring him.
Leave your weapons, but just go ahead and come here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds all right.
Okay.
So anyway, get a hold of us at livefromthepath.org. It's great to talk to you. We've had a great show, and we'll see you next week.